In December of 1910, Sigmund Freud published a short paper entitled On Wild Psychoanalysis. It recounts the story of a patient who was referred to him after suffering intense anxiety in the wake of her divorce. She had gone to a local physician who had told her that the source of her suffering was a lack of sexual satisfaction, an insight he attributed to Freud, and that the only way for her to relieve that suffering was to return to her husband, take a lover, or masturbate. Amongst the three cures that the physician had offered her, there's one noticeable omission, namely, psychoanalysis. My name is Todd Altshuler, and you're listening to the first episode of Methods, a show about ideas and the ways that people think. Each episode is going to tell the story of a concept. Today we'll be exploring the way that the founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, listened to his patients in order to consider the ways that we listen to each other. First, a little history. We find ourselves in turn-of-the-century Vienna. Freud was already quite well-known at this point. He had a modest cabal of followers, including Carl Jung, and a considerable amount of cultural notoriety, or infamy, depending on who you were asking. Despite having discovered the so-called talking cure in 1895 and giving it the name psychoanalysis in the following year, Freud didn't attempt to write a direct account of his technique until 1908, some 13 years later. People looking for insights into his techniques had to search through his case studies from the first decade of the 1900s with their distinctive names like The Rat Man, The Wolf Man, Dora, and Little Hans, as well as his magnum opus, The Interpretation of Dreams. Some scholars have suggested that Freud was in fact reluctant to provide a detailed account of the way that he practiced due to concerns that it would get in the way of treating patients who would often read his new publications. Getting tangled up in theoretical debates with one's psychotherapist is, of course, a highly effective way of derailing any progress. But it's also clear that he was worried that isolated descriptions of his technique, decontextualized and separated off from their intricate scenarios, would fail to capture what psychoanalysis was really about. Perhaps in the tradition of Plato, who staged his philosophical works as dialogues, Freud initially thought of his case studies as the proper medium for learning his method, more in line with the actual experience of listening to a patient. We might say they were training manuals in the form of stories. His frustration at what he took to be the widespread misunderstanding of his ideas, wild psychoanalysis, as it were, seems to have been enough to inspire a change of gears. After a series of fits and starts on what was intended to be a systematic work on the methodology of psychoanalysis, he decided instead upon a series of six papers written between December 1911 and July 1914, which are now commonly referred to as his papers on technique. The third paper in the series, entitled Recommendations for Physicians on the Psychoanalytic Method of Treatment, and the one that we're concerned with here, begins with the discussion of a couple of typical day-to-day problems that therapists run up against. Here he asks, how is a psychoanalyst, who might well be seeing eight or more patients in a single day, supposed to keep track of all the minute details of each person's life? All those names and dates and peculiar symptoms, day after day, month after month, till death do us part. One could almost picture some vast Victorian cabinet of wonders hidden away in Freud's office, containing volumes of frantically scratched out session notes, every little detail accounted for, every Freudian slip recorded and archived. But in fact, Freud recommends not taking notes at all, since he thinks, for one, that it disrupts the doctor-patient rapport. Instead, he suggests a technique that is at once strange, profound, and deceptively simple, what he calls the rule of giving equal notice to everything. Here's Freud. It consists simply in not directing one's attention to anything in particular, and in maintaining the same free-floating attention in the face of all that one hears. This phrase, free-floating attention, sometimes translated as evenly suspended attention, is the crucial idea. It encapsulates a whole way of thinking about what it means to listen to another person. It's a special kind of focus. It's not distracted or careless. It requires one's full attention. And yet, it's not a deep focus, like the kind you would use when you're trying to solve an algebra problem. What makes it free and floating is that it doesn't get fixated on any particular thing. The mind lightly flits from thought to thought, momentarily attending to each as they unfold in real time. It slickly glides along, noticing each expression just as the next one arrives. So, equal attention to everything, but with a light touch, staying in the present moment. Perhaps we would call this today a state of mindfulness. So rather than trying to keep track of every detail, which would quickly press up against the natural limits of our attention span and memory, he suggests a technique that conserves resources and places less strain on the mind of the psychoanalyst. Let the words wash over you, prevent listener burnout. But this is really just the beginning of the story, because it leaves us with an equally pressing question. Is this an effective way to listen to another person if you want to understand what they're saying? How does this free-floating way of listening tune us into meaning? We can begin to think about this through a counterexample. What happens when we do the exact opposite of what he's recommending and fixate on some particular detail? When we focus our attention in this way on a single thing that the person is saying, we're selecting out one thought amongst many. We're privileging it. And in doing so, we're mostly ignoring all the other things that are being said. So when we fixate, we're effectively deciding in the moment what's important and what isn't. And this means that the mere act of focusing, and this is a striking thought, is an interpretation. It's a value judgment. And then we have to ask, on what basis are we making this decision? Well, think about what it's like when you're sitting with a friend and you're listening to them tell a story. What's going through your brain? They're telling you all about the ins and outs of something that happened recently. A romantic breakup. A new boss that won't shut up. Their summer trip to Greece. And if you're anything like me, then first, you're thinking about all the things that you want to say next, which is, of course, a terrible way to listen. And second, you're looking for points of connection, things you can relate to, experiences, emotions, reactions, annoyances, successes, things which are familiar to you. And you can hardly wait to share them. Oh yeah, this reminds me of last summer when I was in Mykonos, and this thing happened, let me tell you about it. Now you're not even remotely listening. It's all about you now, or me in this case. So usually, in everyday conversations, we implicitly decide on what's important in what another person is saying by finding points of connection between them and us. We relate to the other person when we recognize something of ourselves in their stories, which is a nice way of saying we decide on the basis of our narcissism. This is nicely put by the Lacanian psychoanalyst Bruce Fink. Here's Bruce. We tend to hear everything in relation to ourselves. When someone tells us a story, we think of similar stories or more extreme stories we ourselves could tell in turn. We start thinking about things that have happened to us that allow us to relate to the other person's experience, to know what it must have been like, or at least to imagine how we ourselves would have felt had we been in the other person's shoes. In other words, our usual way of listening is centered to a great degree on ourselves, on our own similar life experiences, our own similar feelings, our own perspectives. So this way of listening, what we might call everyday listening, aims to build a connection with the other person through empathy. When you empathize, you're using what's familiar to you, your own feelings and experiences, to imagine what the other person felt or experienced. You're projecting yourself into their inner world, living their experiences vicariously in order to understand them. Now, this is all well and good. It's hard to imagine going through life without these kinds of conversations. But there's also a problem with this way of listening, and this is what Freud's pointing to. If you try to understand the other person on the basis of what you already know and are comfortable with, what you can relate to, then you're reducing their words back down to what's already familiar. You're reducing them back down to you, your ego, your worldview, your preferences, your inclinations. But this isn't really listening, not in the full sense of the word, because really listening means being open to the unfamiliar and the new and the strange and the unexpected. And if you aren't listening for it, it'll slip right past you. Here's Freud again. For as soon as anyone deliberately concentrates his attention to a certain degree, he begins to select from the material before him. One point will be fixed in his mind with particular clearness, and some other will be correspondingly disregarded. And in making this selection, he will be following his expectations or inclinations. This, however, is precisely what must not be done. In making the selection, if he follows his expectations, he's in danger of never finding anything but what he already knows. And if he follows his inclinations, he will certainly falsify what he may perceive. It must not be forgotten that the things one hears are, for the most part, things whose meaning is only recognized later on. So if you select or you fixate on one thing, you're walking down the path of your own expectations. And no matter what is said, the only thing that you're going to find down there is what you started with. In other words, everyday listening leads to what psychologists now call confirmation bias, or when you look for things that confirm your own beliefs and values. It's worth taking a moment to pause and consider this, because it's genuinely surprising. The godfather of talk therapy is telling us that what we would commonly think of as the qualities and behaviors of a good listener, having plenty of empathy, building rapport and connection and so on, can in fact prevent us from really hearing the other person in a fundamental way. And this stems from the fact that everyday conversations are not, for the most part, about listening closely. They're more like a game, a form of play, in which we explore and negotiate our identities and relationships. Is this person like me or not? Do I like them? Do they like me? Do we like the same things? Do we have common ground, or are they on the other side? And if you look at it in this way, it's not all that surprising that we tend to struggle with close listening. The skills and techniques that we learn from everyday conversations, and which we practice from childhood on, are the skills of this game, not the skills of attentive listening. Each conversation, of course, has a different aim. Maybe you're looking to feel better after a bad day. Or you're talking to a friend in need and you want to support them. Or maybe you're trying to make a new friend or a new enemy. What the other person says has a bearing on you, your place in the world, and the things that you want. And what you hear is going to be filtered through what you're looking for. And so we can say that in everyday conversations, you hear through your intentions, interests, and desires. And close listening, listening that does its best to put all this baggage to the side, takes a back seat. So how might we listen differently? And why, you might ask, would we even want to? To put it in simple terms, the problem that we've been speaking about is that everyday listening limits what we can hear. When we interpret another person's words through the lens of the self and our own interests, something gets lost in translation, the unknown and the unfamiliar, what's beyond us. But how else are we supposed to make any sense out of what someone else is saying? Well, as it turns out, the situation is even a little bit worse than this, because there's actually a second problem. Here's Freud from earlier. It must not be forgotten that the things one hears are, for the most part, things whose meaning is only recognized later on. So if the first problem was that everyday listening colors our interpretations, the second problem is that it does this all too quickly in the present. The second problem is time. And we can ask, why is this a problem? Why does Freud think that you can only understand the meaning of what someone is saying later on, after the fact? I mean, we have conversations all the time that seem perfectly intelligible to us in the present. You go into the coffee shop on your way to work and you order a coffee. They bring you a coffee. You go on with your day. Where's the problem? If we want to understand this series of questions, we have to take a brief stroll through Freudian metapsychology, which is a fancy way of saying his view of what the human mind fundamentally looks like. One of the things that Freud is most well known for is the idea that much of what's going on in our minds is under the hood, in the unconscious. And this doesn't just mean vital functions like breathing or sexual instincts, which happen without your having to think about them. It also includes thoughts and affects and desires, which are expressions of our higher level cognition. For Freud, what we consciously experience is like the thin skin that sometimes forms on the top of the cup of milk, which is to say, it's not much. On the other hand, in the Freudian universe, the unconscious is akin to a black hole, an invisible absent center that only makes itself known through its strange distorting effects on everything around it. We sense its presence when it twists and warps the fabric of speech or action, often with comical or uncanny outcomes. The infamous Freudian slip of the tongue, some tiny detail that sticks out that doesn't seem to make sense on the surface, some little idiosyncrasy that might have been passed over in everyday life, a peculiar sensation, a nonsensical act, a dream that haunts you and won't stop repeating. These enigmatic, encrypted messages beeping away, like some alien transmission, driving you a little bit mad, keeping you up at night. It's here that something sneaks through the tightly wound net of consciousness, awkwardly revealing that, as Freud put it, the ego is not master of its own house. These distortions belie a deeper, mostly hidden story about what it means to be you. A story that's often at odds with what we want to think about ourselves or want others to think about us. In Freud's view, we block out thoughts that are truly unacceptable or incomprehensible to us as individuals, as egos, as selves. Some part of us represses them or censors them, holding them down so that they don't enter into consciousness. But even so, they continue to press on us, challenging their exile. And they do something very clever to circumvent the censorship and find a way into consciousness. They deploy a kind of cryptography. They make it past the threshold of awareness by concealing their meaning, encoding themselves as ciphers and riddles, more commonly known as symptoms. These little packets of pain, suffering, embarrassment, and confusion are expressions of something meaningful that's been blocked out and is trying to find another way in. And encryption is their trademark. They appear to us as nonsensical, meaningless, trivial, to be passed over or tuned out as quickly as possible, mere static that's degrading the clear transmission of our wants and intentions. But in fact, they're part of the transmission itself, a primary and fundamental part, which communicates through the negative space of our manicured self-image. The unconscious makes itself known in absentia through its effects, and these effects become manifest as disruptions and ruptures in the ordinary flow of meaning. To listen for the unconscious is to attend to these odd ripples in the otherwise smooth, controlled prattle of consciousness as it tries to tell us all kinds of pleasing stories about the way things are. To listen for the parts that don't immediately make sense, the parts that are difficult or impossible to relate to, or at first appear foreign and unintelligible, the fractures or contradictions in the story that remain hidden in plain sight, which is often the best place to hide something. Freud called this kind of listening free-floating attention. The psychoanalyst Theodor Reich, borrowing from Nietzsche, would later call it listening with the third ear. And now we can see why Freud says that, for the most part, the meaning of what one says only arrives later on, after the fact. He's listening for expressions of the unconscious, and these expressions show up within consciousness in encrypted form, looking or sounding like nonsense. If they could be understood upon arrival, they wouldn't make it past the censors. By their very nature, they can't be taken at face value or understood immediately in the present. They have to be deciphered through the work of association and exploration, which is a bit like untangling a frustrating knot which seems to be fighting back. And this is the long, hard slog of psychoanalysis. And so the lesson of Freud's metapsychology is that the mind is at odds with itself. This is part of its very structure. On the one hand, it implements forms of censorship or repression to protect us from the disorienting impact of thoughts and experiences that we can't quite absorb in the moment. On the other hand, it tables them for later discussion and then insists upon having those discussions with us, whether we like it or not. This is the return of the repressed. And so our minds exhibit a strange kind of time, where meaning hovers in a suspended state, delayed and displaced, somewhere in between the past and the future. Traces of the past persist in the unconscious as little fragments of thought and memory, only to reemerge once again in unexpected and inconvenient ways. And yet their meaning is constantly being rewritten in terms of the present and who you've become. Memory is not a storehouse of digital reproductions. It's a dynamic living network that opens onto the current moment. The present is always rewriting the past, transforming it paradoxically into something entirely new that's somehow been there all along. Pieces arrange and rearrange one another, modulating their weights and balances, producing new configurations. This is why, in Freud's view, something that we experience in childhood as inconsequential or merely out of place can reemerge in our adult lives as something wholly traumatic and world-shattering. Meaning performs a peculiar type of temporal dance that's unlike the forward march of the clock. There's a kind of retroactivity or retrospectiveness to it, what psychoanalysts call Nachtraglichkeit, or afterwardness. A moment can be woken up, reactivated, and reveal new insights, or a fissure that splinters your sense of self. The small detail that you'd casually passed over, which turns out to be the breakthrough you were looking for all along, or the sign of a betrayal that was staring you right in the face. Freud's insight is that our minds aren't linear, and in turn, neither is listening. If you want to understand, you have to learn to play by its rules and its sense of time, where the past, present, and future are continually intermingling and causing all kinds of trouble, as well as genuinely new possibilities. The difficulty with this is that it leaves us with anxiety. We're understanding addicts. We want to know as quickly as possible. When things don't make sense, it's uncomfortable, unpleasant, strenuous, stressful, and exhausting. It's a kind of tension that we're compelled to get rid of, a gap that we want to fill in with reasons and explanations and causes. When we're faced with the unknown, the hairs on the back of our psyche stand up. This is anxiety. This is what we always seem to be trying to get away from. And yet listening, at least initially, means not understanding. This is its precondition, trudging about in the mire. To listen is to hold open the space into which something can emerge. It's to be in two times at once, freely floating between the past and what is yet to be understood. Being together with another person, in that in-between, as the landscape slowly emerges, bit by bit, within the mind's camera obscura. Listening means giving oneself over to the time of unknowing. This episode was produced with original music by Dexter Mason and additional research by Sasha Volters. You can find out more about each episode on our website, methods.fm, including sources and additional reading. Thanks for listening.